Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ
106.5
FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Oh, welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I'm your host today, Al Warren, of course. Who else? And David North Martino is making the martinis.
I'm right back here doing that. Thanks, Al.
I'll have mine shaken.
Not stirred.
Well, anyway, so we are back for another great day. And we have a returning guest, a guy that's hopped in here before. We got Garrick Jones, who's got a new book out called The Gilded Madonna. Garrick, thank you for being here.
Good morning, guys. Good day, I should say.
Good day.
Good morning. Good day.
Good day. So you're writing about Madonna?
No.
Well, that's just, you know, I mean, I have to start slow. It's America.
That's the first time that association has come into my mind since I started writing this book 2 years ago.
Well, I'll take it for me to do that, you know. I bring out the worst in everyone. So you've been doing this for 2 years.
This book's been, I finished it probably well over 18 months ago when I finished the first write, and then I put it aside for 3 or 4 months because there were other projects going on. This is the way that I write, to let it sort of cook in my unconscious, to go back to do the first rewrite. And then the editing process is really quite long. I don't know if other writers have mentioned this, but it usually takes, you get the first time you get your developmental edits, which you've got to work on, and then you go through a line edit and then do all those, and it goes back for a developmental edit. Then you submit it to the publisher, and then the publisher decides when it's going to be published in their timetable. So, yeah, it takes sometimes a long time for books after you've written before they're released.
Oh, yeah. Especially mine, you know, they're so poorly written. So this is the Clyde Smith Mysteries. So this is book two
of the second book in that, yeah.
So let's get into that a little bit. So first of all, let's talk about Clyde Smith. Who is Clyde Smith?
Clyde Smith is a local Sydney boy who went to fight during the Second World War and was captured in Italy and interned in a prisoner of war camp, Macerata, on the east coast of Italy for 3 years. And then when he returns to Australia, becomes a policeman, becomes a detective, and then eventually, after 9 years on the job, he gets really fed up with the corruption that existed in the New South Wales police force at the time, and resigns and decides to become a part-time journalist and run his own private detective agency. So that's Clyde. He's got a lot of baggage, this man.
Yeah. And you talk about this. So this is written in you were saying, 1956, or written for that time period.
Yep.
There was a lot of corruption and reality in the police department.
Oh, there sure was. Yeah, the New South Wales Police Force was well known for round paper packets under the table and deals with criminal gangs and stuff. Yeah, there was a lot of problems. And it was a lot of the guys who didn't go to war for various reasons manned the police station. They got promoted just because they were the only people left. And so when in the early, late 1940s, when men came back and they looked for jobs, they found out all the senior positions were just stocked with these lazy guys who were on the take, basically.
Yeah. So you had a lot of stuff to work with, like reality to base this on.
Yeah, and also my mother's boyfriend was a detective sergeant in charge of the vice squad just after that time in the early 1960s. So I heard a lot of stuff that was going on. At the moment, there's a television program going on about there was a fire in Australia in an amusement park where seven children were burned to death in a ghost train ride. And it's just been exposed that one of the head criminal members of the narcotics ring ordered for that fire to be lit. And the head of the investigation squad was in his pocket. So all the details were covered up. Yeah, there was some really nasty stuff going on.
Yeah, I just saw the show on going through Australian crime in the 60s and about that guy that was... Oh, he was a big serial killer, but yet the police had arrested and put other people away, even though they knew it wasn't them.
Well, I'm going to get onto this. This is William McDonald, and he's the character I've based as the antagonist, the major figure in who's fighting Clyde or against Clyde in this story is based on the story of William McDonald, who was a serial killer who is responsible for the death of five men. Mostly derelicts, but he was known as the mutilation murderer for, as you can probably understand why, he loved to eviscerate his victims and very fond of cutting off their dicks and sticking them in their mouths and, you know, pretty gruesome. Ooh. And in fact, one of the killings happened in a public toilet next to the high school I was attending at the time. So I remember that very well because we were all evacuated from the school, and then for the next week we had police escorting us to and from school on buses and trams and wandering around the grounds. So I used that as one of my themes. I actually picked three themes of the history about the time to weave into this new book. I thought it was very interesting to see how I could link these three disparate stories into one crime. And I hope it really works well. The editor really liked it, and so did the publisher, so his fingers crossed.
Yeah. No, I think that's incredible. I love that. That's the best type of crime book you can get, mystery book, is because it's got so much of the time and so much truth involved in it that you can't help but follow it through.
Especially if you can weave some first-hand experience through into it. You know, I remember that time. It was very frightening at the time, you know, that this guy was... He was originally British. He came to Australia, and when he was eventually captured, he was captured in New Zealand and deported back to Australia. He said to the police that he admitted to the killings, and he blamed them on an irresistible urge to kill, as his words. And he said that he was a victim of rape as a teenager, and had to disempower his victims that he chose at random, because of that atonement for his violation as a child. So one of the other stories that's linked through to this is the ritual abuse of young men and boys in foster homes and in orphanages in Australia right back to the turn of the 20th century.
And that's pretty amazing. Because a lot of times, especially lately, when I go through books and stories like this, quite often they get a lot of things wrong, and they don't do enough research. And I know, just you having the personal experience and your writing, that this will be very, very, very accurate.
Well, times have changed. You know, when I contacted the New South Wales Police Archive, the archivist there was incredibly helpful with details of the other cases of the abuse of boys and prosecutions and what they could do and what they couldn't do at the time. So I got a lot of primary source material from them. And also, do you remember I was talking last time about my book Wheelchair, where I interviewed all these dozens of men about role play and about abuse? One of the guys there mentioned that he had been abused in a boys' home. So I got back to him when I was writing this book, and I asked if he'd be interested in sharing his experiences. And he and four of his mates were very, very forthcoming about what it was like growing up in an orphanage in outback New South Wales in the 1950s. It was heartbreaking. Just such bravery, these guys, to be able to reveal what they went through. So I asked their permission, and a lot of the episodes in the book are actually based on what happened to them. I mean, what these men did to these kids, it's just hard to believe. It's just impossible to believe in my mind. I don't understand it.
Yeah. Yeah, and then how they got away with it, too.
Well, a lot of the church-run homes, of course, it was just all covered up and swept under the carpet. But a lot of the private homes were financed by organised crime. A lot of people don't know that. But the government paid the managers of these private orphanages a certain amount of money to look after the kids. And, of course, the kids didn't see that money. But a lot of it went back into crime lords as a form of protection. And also gangsters would turn up and pick their kids and take them up into a back room. It's just horrible.
Yeah. Yeah.
It sounds like a crime fiction book, but you know, it's truth.
Yeah, well, that makes a good. There's a reality to it that you're following, and I think that's amazing. I think that's the best way to put this kind of.
This is a long book. It's my longest book. It's 435 pages in the printed copy, so it's a pretty decent sized book. But there are three major strands going on through the book that ultimately are tied up at the end. It's the sort of way I love to read mystery books, that there seems to be three different things that aren't connected, but somehow they eventually come together and you read and you think back and go, oh yeah, I got the clue back there earlier on. I like those sort of books, and I try to write that when I'm writing my mystery stories.
Yeah. Now, so when you go back to the times, it was quite different than it is now, and I know that, you know that. Even Dave is not quite as old, but we all sort of understand the big changes, like how different our life was compared to what it is now.
Yeah, and I think that's a very difficult thing to communicate to the younger generation, because we often see history in terms of our own social values and contemporary ideas. So when we look back and we see life in the 1950s for gay men especially, we see it through the eyes of McCarthyism in the United States, because that's basically the great dissemination of information, I call it the, and I don't mean this unkindly, but the US cultural steamroller, that there's so much that comes out of the US that it pervades everything. So the ideas of what life was like for the gay men all over the world come from the persecution of McCarthyism period in America, where there was plainclothes arrests and entrapment and all that sort of stuff. But it wasn't the same all over the world. I grew up fortunately, and I say this fortunately with the right meaning, with a gay godfather. And my mother was a neglectful mother, and I spent a lot of time in my godfather's care. And I met all of these grown up adult men who are politicians and tennis players and judges and lawyers and, you know, bricklayers, all sorts of things at his parties. And as a kid, I just thought they were blokes. I had no idea. It wasn't until I became about, I suppose, 12 or 13, and I suddenly realised that they were all gay. But they were not sleeping with each other. It was a sort of like social outlet. So there was a lot of happiness, and there was a lot of successful relationships covered up, although people tended to mind their own business a lot more back in the 50s than they do now. It was considered impolite to talk about certain matters in case you were seen as a gossip. So I think that the life was quite different. I mean, men went about their lives just being men, and they just went home to another guy instead of a wife. It was no big thing. It was a secret. But I think men were a little bit paranoid that they might get arrested, because you'd be arrested at being a gathering, for example, of more than 15 men, I think it was in New South Wales, without one woman present. stupid rules. So you could have some, really butch dyke there, you know.
The fag.
But that was fine. Yeah. It wasn't a gay party.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're all doing the girl there. Well, no.
You've only got to look at long-term happy relationships. Benjamin Britten and Peter Pears, for example, the famous British composer and his lifetime companion, yeah. And Montgomery Scott and Cary Grant. You know, all these people having relationships, keeping it quiet, but being buddies, you know.
Yeah.
It was very different.
But
it wasn't all. Yeah, it wasn't all about, you know, hiding in the closet and lonely men, you know, masturbating into their pillow looking at physique magazines. Although I'm sure there was quite a lot of that going on too.
There still is. No, but that, yeah, I mean, people have to realize that it wasn't. There was sort of a strength having our own community as well.
Yeah. What we do forget, and I think this is really important, a lot of men, there was a lot of men didn't have any sexual activity before World War II. A lot of young men, there wasn't the amount of sexual freedom back in the 1930s and early 1940s as there is today. So women didn't, were a bit more choosy about who they slept with. So a lot of guys were virgins when they went to the war, and they discovered same sex, like jerking off together or whatever, being exposed to naked men. And some of them got a taste for that. And when they came back to their home countries after the war, they were forced into positions of having to look for it in, you know, places that weren't so nice.
Yeah.
You know, parks and clubs and bars and stuff like that. But they still got married because that's what society expected of them. And then you find out in the 1970s and early 1980s, all of these guys suddenly decided that they were gay after all and leaving their wife and their kids and running off with a 17-year-old Filipino houseboy. I'm sure we all know those stories, don't we?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Ding dong. It's just, I don't know. Yeah, but I think it's come a long way.
It sure has.
But in the countries like, you know, like in Canada and Australia and stuff like that, I think the difference is gay couples have assimilated. They're mixed right in mainstream society now. They don't have to be as segregated as they are in the U.S.
Well, I think that there's also, that's true, but I think there's also a duality within gay men. There are people who identify with gay culture. And then there are just guys who are just guys who just happen to sleep with other men, and they don't define themselves necessarily as gay. I think there's that duality that exists within our community as well.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, there's all sorts of things, and people are being a lot freer about what they want to do now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't walk around with a rainbow flag on my forehead.
No, God, I'm the guy that's about me. I do what I do and just happen to like men. That's just
yeah, well, yeah, know. And I think that we're probably we're the part that's not the tip of the iceberg. We're the large block of ice underneath the water.
Yeah,
you know, but I must say that I've started putting a little rainbow flag on my book covers now, because I've had a number of people read my books and go, oh, this is all about poofters. Read the blurb. Read the description of the book.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
If it says gay men, you're bound to find some gay men in the book.
Right, you know, and that's kind of a problem. But that's still...
Then, Yeah, but then on the other hand, I get lots of really nice emails from guys who say that they're straight, that their wives have bought the book and they read it, and how surprised they are to see how similar we are. That's pretty gobsmacking, actually.
Yeah.
That's a mind bend, you know, how similar we are. I shake my head. I go, well, yeah.
Well, you know, a lot of people don't realize what it is. They think it's something totally alien, and something it's where they grow up. It's who they're around. It's what they're told, and there's still a lot of that. And I think it's getting better overall. It's just sort of a time thing.
Yeah. I was just thinking that this morning, actually, when I heard the news about the young guy who's, 24, who drove in and killed a policeman this morning.
At the White House, yeah.
Yeah. And I thought to myself, what sort of upbringing did that guy have? What sort of education did he have that let him down to make rational, logical conclusions from evidence?
Right.
That's got to be either in upbringing or in schooling. People just don't develop hate out of thin air unless something really traumatic has happened to them.
Well, it always comes from a fear, or a fear of ourselves, something we don't like internally. And then who we're around is what we develop our skills to work out of these things. And sometimes it's not that good. You know?
Well, yeah. I try to think about when I'm writing my villains. Nobody wants to read a cardboard cutout, a two-dimensional character. We need to know what motivates people to be bad. There's got to be some reason. As human beings, we have to know what causes people to act the way that they do. Otherwise, we turn into two-dimensional cardboard cutouts ourselves. And so when I'm writing about the villains, I try to it's not about sympathy, but to explain why they're driven to do the things that they do. Otherwise, you end up writing sort of one of those dollar novels you buy at a gas station when you're driving across the country to read while you're bored.
I write those. don't be putting them down. Listeners, remember, I write all those ones. So
okay. I think I've got a few of those holding my monitor up at the moment.
That's you know what? People pay for them. It's all that matters.
Look, I get into this whole romance thing all the time because people say to me, oh, there's such a beautiful romance in this book. And I go, well, there is, but it's not the focus of the story, and I don't write romance. I've got nothing about it. But that's a particular genre where there are certain expectations of the way the plot develops and the way the story ends that I don't do. So I don't describe myself as a romance writer, and I'm really, really happy for people to write it and to read it, but don't ask me to because that's not my thing.
Yeah,
I don't do it well. Yeah. I mean, I don't write boy meets boy, you know, third party gets in the way, and then they end up, you know, buying two dogs and a house in the Hamptons.
After they kill the third party.
Well, that would be at least, you know, that would be interesting. But then that doesn't happen, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in this latest book, I spent a lot of time exploring the background of the antagonist, this guy who is the baddie, for a better word, in the book, and drawing out his motivations throughout the book not in upfront ways, because you don't want to spoil the surprise before you find out who he is, but at least giving clues along the way so that when you get there you understand a little bit why he does it, even though you don't agree to the reason for his killings.
So is that kind of... What is the subtext? Like, what do you want people to get out of the book? Is there something you're trying to get across?
Well, what I want to get across, basically, is this notion that men in the 1950s, if they'd fought in the Second World War and they'd actually been in a combat zone or been involved in anything, were basically flawed. I grew up with a family of flawed men. I didn't know what it was like to meet, you know, sort of pretty normal guys on a much later in life, because my father had fought in New Guinea against the Japanese. My uncle had fought in Korea and then went on to be afterwards in the occupation forces in Japan. My family uncle, you know, those people, family friends who you call Uncle Joe and Auntie Mary, but they aren't related. Mm-hmm. He was tortured to death in by the Japanese building the Burma Railway. The guy who lived next door, the woman who lived next door, her two sons, one of them was killed working on them beside the Americans in 1942. And then his brother was shot down and killed in Germany working as an Australian pilot, seconded to the Air Force in Britain. So there was these men had brought back all of this, you know, hidden inside. And after the euphoria of getting home and the new world, new modern world, you know, first 5 or 6 years after the war, everything was new and exciting, all of a sudden the demons come back and started biting them in the arse. And these guys, you know, would burst into tears for no reasons, or they'd smash bottles, the rage, the impotence. And, of course, they were told to man up and get on with it. And so that was one of the main reasons behind this particular book. And, in fact, I start to explore Clive's life during his years as a prisoner of war, first by the Italians and then later the Germans when the Italians left the Axis Pact in 1944, and the camp was taken over by Germans. The brutality and what makes him the person, why he finds it so difficult to form relationships, and his relationship that he has at the moment so difficult to maintain, because carrying around this incredible burden of what happened to him.
Hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of people that talk about how the Second World War and the descendants out of that created a lot of killers, a lot of serial killers.
So a lot of gay men will tell you, and I remember when my godfather's friends, when they found out what was happening with gay persecution and trap and everything, they would say, what the f*** were we fighting for?
Yeah.
You know, the Second World War was sabotaged by a whole lot of very right-wing movements to create a society that they thought it should be, rather than to benefit. You know, the vast fortunes of America were made by turning arms manufacturing into white goods and selling that to householders across America, giving everybody the dream home, and of course that idea pervaded right across the world. So then all of a sudden you were judged by what you had rather than who you were.
Yeah, you kind of, it makes you wonder what the generation being born into what we have going on now will turn out like.
Yeah, I don't know. I probably won't be around. It's bad enough at the moment. When I was, look, I retired nearly 8 years ago and I was lecturing at university, and I cannot tell you how I used to wring my hands and pull my hair when I would read assignments written by students who are brought up in this new liberal type education where spelling and grammar and attention to detail and logical thought wasn't important.
Yeah, yeah.
The
world is
It's a different, there's a different, look, I understand that there's a whole lot more freedom, and people are given far more choice. I went to a high school where you had two choices. You're either going to be a doctor or a lawyer, or you were going to be a white-collar worker in some other thing. You didn't go there if you were going to be a labourer. So that the subjects were tailored around those outcomes, and they consisted of the basic things in Latin for 5 years and ancient Greek in case you want to become a doctor or a lawyer. And we had history of the world, both European and back to prehistory and Asian.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
We had geography and we had chemistry and physics, and that was basically it. So he came out with a very, I suppose, highly refined intellectual pursuit at the end, but you didn't come out with any sort of common knowledge, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah, for sure. Yes.
So we get kids now who are all full of pop culture, but if you ask them who Ronald Reagan was, they ask you who's a relative of Ronald McDonald, you know.
Yeah. It's true. It's
no
true.
History.
I wonder where it's going to go with that, but I wonder how far we'll go.
Well, I think the major problem is that young people don't read. They don't actually read books. And they certainly don't study history. I'm saying this is on a whole,
yeah.
Because there are major exceptions. But on a whole, I remember I had a lecture class, which is the comparative history of the arts and sciences in the 19th century. And I would ask basic questions, you know, to the students, and they had no understanding of the things that formed our society even today. You know, people, this presumption that they had electric lights in 1830, you know.
And a bathroom in their home.
Yeah, so I think that we do, you know, this liberal education has done a disservice in many ways. I mean, kids are computer smart, for example, like that. But we can't, if we look back at the patterns, I'm at an age now, I look back and I go, gosh, shit, I remember that happening. Went back in so-and-so, and I remember that happening even before. So you get some perspective of things being cyclical. And I don't know that young people really have that world experience yet.
Are you going to keep this going with Clive?
Yeah, I am going to keep it. I've actually got the notes for the third book, and I'm just waiting. I've got a manuscript to send off tomorrow for its final proofread for a book which will come out in July. And then I've finished the first rewrite on a Victorian-era spy thriller, which will probably come out early next year. But while in that period between the proofread and the publication of the book in July, I'm going to start writing the third book of the Clyde Smith trilogy.
How is that to do? You know, in a sense, when you've got a character like Clyde Smith and you're working them in three or four different books in a whole series, you have to develop the character, but you have to carry on with that character. It's not.
Yeah, now look, this is very interesting. I maybe send you the link. I wrote a blog about the serious problem of writing a series and how you start off a new book. I don't like serious books which start off with in the previous episode.
Right.
And then there's a huge exposition about what the story. You need to be able to weave that into the narrative of the book in a way that gives familiarity to the reader who's read the book before, but you also have to write your books as a standalone, because you can't guarantee that people won't pick up the second or third book in your series and not enjoy it because they don't know what the hell's happened before. So I think that there's I think it's a problem. And when I was mapping this book out, I thought there's a simple way to do this. This is to gradually weave in the characters into the story as you're writing it, so that the familiarity comes back to people who've read the book before, but to new people they're introduced to these major characters. Now, talking of this, look, when you're writing a series, it's about somebody's life, and I don't believe that you can suddenly start a new book with a whole new universe of people. Life isn't like that. We have known people as friends, you know, maybe 20, 30 years. So when you write a book and all of a sudden you introduce a character and you start talking about them in book three and you talk about this thing that happened back in book one, I don't think that works for me. You need to be back in book one, have already created your universe, including that person. So when I started writing the first book, I created the University of Clive's life, all the people around him, and I got a few negative comment reviewers saying, there are too many people in this book. I feel like writing, yeah, go read Anna Karenina or War and Peace and then tell me about too many people. You know, so if you can't hold seven or eight characters in your mind when you're reading a book, then you need to go read Disney comics, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I write those too.
In the back of my mind, I wanted to write this really rude email to this person and say, well, you know, why is so-and-so, you mentioned that this person is not necessary. Wait till book three and then you'll find out why he's so important.
Yeah.
Because, you know, so it is important to create your universe. And I think that good series writers do that. We develop friendships not only with the major characters, but with also the minor characters. We need to identify, we need to give them a story, because that's what makes your book, puts flesh on the bones of your book. Am I making sense with that?
Yeah, I would think so, because the worst thing in the world, and I think a writer can get into trouble here, if all of a sudden in book three or book four you create a character that apparently knew someone in book one, and you can get into trouble just kind of trying to create something past tense to fit in with where you're going, right? Like, especially in future editions. I think that can be a trouble, right? So I think you're right.
I did exactly the same with the 7th of December series, which is the book about, you interviewed me before last year. And the sequel to that is the book that comes out in July, and that carries on directly half an hour after the last book finished. But that was particularly difficult series to write because it included a huge narrative from the book before that hadn't been resolved. So weaving that in carefully through the story was particularly tough, and that took a long time to write. I was writing that over about 3 years, I think, in between other projects. A lot of people say, hey, you know, you're publishing two or three books a year, you must be churning them out. But then I have to explain that I retired 8 years ago, and it was only 6 years ago that my first book was published. So I did a lot of writing in those 6 years before, being really timid about whether I knew I could write or not. It was only when my first book got published and the publisher said, what else have you got, that I realised that I could write.
Right.
Although I still doubt it.
Yeah. No, that never goes away. I don't think it ever will, right? That imposter syndrome, they call it. That'll never go away. So just move on.
Yeah.
I think that, yeah, you know, and plus you have more than one going at a time, right? You have several going.
Well, what I do is I tend to finish writing one book, and then I put it aside, and I'm either doing a rewrite of the next book straight after that, or I start writing the next book, and then I go back and revisit. I always try to give myself at least a period of 3 or 4 months to basically forget what I've written so I can go back and see it with fresh eyes. I know a lot of people don't work like that, but when I reread it with distance, I can see structural plot problems or character failings that I haven't got the character arcs right, or I refine the language, or I think that this is too dry or there's too much dialogue. We need a bit of a descriptor here to give. Nobody wants to ever read two heads in an empty room. You know, we need to know what people are doing and why they're doing it. And to me, motivation is everything. There's no point saying, I get so annoyed with some movies where people do stuff and you go, why the f*** did they do that? I mean, what caused them to get up and off the table and shoot their wife in the head and jump out the window and commit suicide with no reason, you know? So figuring out that motivation and building through the storyline is what interests me the most in writing, I suppose. It's called OneNote. And you should see my OneNote for each book. I have, on each of the pages for the characters, I have photographs of who I think they look like. I have quotes from the book. I have their traits, their habits, you know, what they like to do, what they wear, all that sort of stuff. So that when I'm writing about that person again, I can go to refer to it and then start work on it. So, for example, when I start work on the third Clyde Smith book, I will read both the first book and the second book straight one after each other again so that I really get the world, the time, the place and the people in my mind. And I'm not going to write more than two series. A lot of people have written to me and say, please write a sequel to Australia's Son. And I just go, no, I can't cope with more than two series. It's bad enough making two couples, two main character couples, different. Whereas a third couple would be just impossible. They'll all end up sort of being a bit of each other rather than being totally different.
How do you, so you're now I can't remember with you. Now some of your supporting characters, right, where do they come from for you? Are they also kind of based after reality people?
For example, the guy who runs Australia's biggest gay bookstore, Graham Aitken, who's a great supporter, he has my books in his bookshop in Sydney in the Gay Mile. He had just went to have a holiday in a new resort in Coogee, which is the suburb I grew up in. He sent me some photos. I had immediately this flashback of exactly what it was like in 1955, 1956. So creating that atmosphere is one of the things that leads you back into the time period, the zeitgeist, everything that was going on. And, of course, growing up there, you know, it's very easy to remember what you were doing at that time.
When you're going through a story like this, and you've been writing with this character, you also are putting a lot of your own self into this. You're putting a lot
of
your
course.
Own experience, your own things. So that opens up a vulnerability that also exposes something of yourself to everybody that reads. So how do you decide what you're going to let people know about you?
I think that every single one of us has what we call a public persona, who we would like the world to believe who we are, and then there's this private person behind who is usually a lot more vulnerable and susceptible to many other things that we, especially men, don't want the world to know because it would make us feel weak. And I think one of the big steps is being allowing to come out. Mind you, don't forget, I had 30 years on the stage as a performer, so I got used to exposing all of those weaknesses inside, things you can't perform without letting that out.
Right.
So when I wrote Wheelchair, it was exceptionally difficult for me because all about childhood abuse and having OCD and PTSD, that was terrifying to me. But I used that as a therapeutic tool to try and come to grips and to explain and things that had happened to me and my thoughts and put them down on the page. I mean, the protagonist in that isn't me, but there's a lot of him, of me that's in there. I mean, you can't invent feelings. You've got to, I don't know about you when you're writing, when you say A said something to B and B reacted, you've got to understand why that person said that thing in the first place and how the other person reacted. It can't be just, otherwise it becomes this weird, you know, a reality TV show where there's no why or wherefore to anything.
Yeah.
So that can only come within you, from within yourself. Where else does it come from? Even if you're doing a lot of reading, you read something and go, wow, I never thought of that. And then you start to think about it and translate it into your own life experiences. Well, I do. I don't know about anybody else.
Well, there's a disbelief in a sense.
Oh, there is a disbelief. And then people, you know, when the people read fiction, they think it's all made up. But if they knew that it wasn't all made up, then they might think differently. Did you ever read A Little Life? I can't remember the name of the author now. It was an extraordinary book. It devastated me. It took a couple of years for me to read it because I kept having putting it down all the time because it spoke to me so strongly. And it was a novel and it was made up, but there was some truth in it. And I don't like to read anything or watch anything that hasn't got truth in it. That's just me. I'm happy for people to read, you know, I don't know, whatever your women's magazine heartthrob stories are. I'm happy for people to do that, but I'm not interested. I want to know that I want to make contact with the reader. Even if it's only one reader who understands a sentence that I've written and it speaks to them, then I feel that my job's done as a writer.
It's not necessarily about the volume. It's just about the connection and the quality of what you do.
Yeah, and maybe that's never going to make money, but that's not why you write.
Mm.
There's a well-known author at the moment who's writing some romance to actually earn some bucks. And
yeah,
I quite understand that.
It's a good business on the side.
Yeah, but I couldn't do it. You know, I'm not interested in that particular genre, and I don't depreciate it. I don't put it down. I don't think it's terrible. I'm just not interested in it. Because unless there's some character development, there's some truth behind the situations, I'm not really interested. You know, that's just like the most bitter comment I've ever had in a review is, I like these books, but let me warn you, Reedy, you actually have to read them.
Well, I mean, that's no good.
It's amusing, but it's also quite, you know, I don't know, that stung me a bit. I thought, well, who skim reads? And obviously a million people do, a gazillion people do.
That's the deal. Right. I mean, because I think the idea of the person that reads the book and then they read it 2, 3, 4 times, several times, because each time they read it, they get something new and there's more in it that they realize. I'm not sure that that's really kind of how a lot of readers read now.
No, I'm sure that they don't. They probably did 50 years ago.
Yeah.
I don't know what happens in English classes in Canada anymore, but we were...
It's French.
I went to a French school in Canada too, so I understand that. But, in Australia, when we were reading books, you know, we analysed them, and I had a wonderful Egyptian refugee teacher in English at high school, and he delved into the books we were reading from the point of view of the characters and why the motivation. I think that's what actually stimulated the love of it for me. I want to know about people. I don't want to know about reality TV. I don't want to know about the Kardashians. I certainly don't want to know about the Trumps. I want to know about real people.
Yeah. Yeah, people you can relate to.
Yeah.
People with real lives that intertwine.
Yeah, you know? I'm not putting myself on any writing platform saying that my sort of writing is, you know, better or denser. It's just different. And it's aimed at a specific audience, which is people who like a bit of mystery and who like... in our complex story that actually is about people and why the good people and why the bad people do the things that they do. And I make all of my main characters slightly flawed, like all of us human beings. The great joy to me is not so much the reviews, but it's the private emails that I get from readers. I have another great mate who writes, and he says he rarely gets emails, but he gets hundreds of reviews. Yet I get probably 20, 30 reviews for each of my books, but I get lots and lots of emails. Sometimes I get, you know, maybe 15 a week. I don't know if it's because people are shyer in this country to express their opinions in case they get shot down, but people write really nice personal things about the books, about characters, the things that I've said in the books, and quite of those, I've started up a correspondence with those. I don't think that you can avoid not to engage with your reading public, not because they're going to buy another book, but because if they're interested in what you write, then they're obviously interesting people.
Yeah.
So engaging with interesting people is what life's all about, surely.
I love the pictures.
Look, I get a number of those too, don't worry.
they're the favorite.
No, oh, God.
No, they're not, I know.
But I don't write sex scenes, which is the crazy thing. I fade to black.
Yeah.
My first collection of books out, The Boys from Boolaroo, was about, there was far more, you know, nitty-gritty in that. And funnily enough, it's been my bestseller. Maybe I should go back to that. I struggle with the time. You know, when I retired, I thought I'd done a lot of writing, academic writing, when I was lecturing at university. And it was only when my the head of my department said, what are you going to do when you retire? You should write a book, she said. You write really, really well, and all your academic writing is really well received. And I thought, oh, I've never written a book before. And she said, write about something you know. And that's what started it off. And I just don't see, I spend my days spent either researching or writing. And I find an enormous amount of joy. It fills my life. I mean, I live by myself in a town where most of the people that I knew have moved away. So I don't have a big social network. So other than that, what would I be doing? Sitting on the couch, putting on, you know, 100 pounds, watching crap on the TV. But right. It gives me, you know, people like it, they like it. You can't make people like what you do. I learnt that as a performer. I've done performances where, you know, the crowd shrieked after performance and you get this review saying, this is shoddy performance, you know, like, it's all perception, different people's perceptions, and no author can control that unless you pay your audience. There's actually a bit of, let's graphic sex in this latest book, but the antagonist has some unusual sexual activities, and I won't mention anything more than that because it'll spoil the part of the plot development, you know. But also, I remember when you were saying, yeah, when I was talking about my friend visiting Coogee and me remembering the part, you were asking about the secondary characters and how are they based on me or who are they based on. Well, there's in both books there's this focus on sea bars, which are on the northern end of Coogee Beach, which is still there. But in my day, there were men-only bars, and they had one of the few steam rooms in Sydney, apart from the Turkish baths in the middle of Sydney. And as it was so close to the major race course for Sydney, a lot of the jockeys used to go there in the steam room, you know, steam off weight and stuff like that. But it was also in the days of men only, no swimming costumes. So it was a big sort of pickup place. And I was very close friends with the son of the owner at the time. And we used to go swimming there free all the time. And I was never aware, of course, until later on, much later on, what was going on. But it was quite normal. It wasn't sort of like a cruisy baths as far as I imagine them. It was just sort of like sitting around smoking and talking and everything and then disappearing off around the rocks or into one of the changing rooms or something. But that's the character who owned that is based on Clyde Smith's best friend who he grew up with, who owns those bars. And the bars feature in both books as points of setting off different parts and action in the story, information gathering that leads to other parts of the story. And also in this book, there's a bit of a dealing with the supernatural, which is another thing I wanted to deal with a bit. Part of the story deals around the police dealing with a psychic. And that's very, very interesting. I did a lot of research on that, and I used a couple of cases from the 1950s from the New South Wales Police Force to base that examination. And it has to do with the Gilded Madonna, the name of the book.
Ooh, sounds very exciting.
Exciting. I hope it is. I mean, it took a lot of work to get draw all the pieces together. And
No, but it sounds great. It sounds like you've done all the work. It sounds perfect.
Yeah.
And now, so how do people get it? And what's your website or what's...
I have a website, which is www.garrickjones.com.au. And all my available books there. There are a number of blogs that refer... There's a page for each book of the 7 books I've had published. And there's details, there's some reviews on some of the books. There's also links to blog pages of history that has to do about the particular book. If I'm writing an historical fiction book, I tend to write a bit about what happened at the time that cradles that supports the storyline and the people in the times. There's also links to Amazon, but the paperback will be available in bricks and mortar shops worldwide. You just go to your local bookstore and order it in. It's also available on Amazon, on Smashwords. Target will be stocking it. That's a big surprise to me that Target stocks my gay books. Wow, where's the world coming to?
Yeah.
And you know, normally Barnes & Noble, all of those major stores. The one in Canada is, I can't remember what it's called now.
Chapters Indigo, I think.
Yes, Indigo. They have it. And it went live on the 2nd, which is the 2nd there today in Canada?
Yes.
Yeah, so it would go live today. I checked the Amazon sites. It seems to be up there now. So it's readily available. The ebook is available on Smashwords, on Amazon, any of other retailers. If Australian listeners, if you buy it from the bookshop Darlinghurst, run by my great mate Graham Atkin, they hold all my books and they post Australia wide. And I did notice this morning, I don't know if it's just in Australia or the US, there's a $10 discount if you spend over $39.95 on books. So if you wanted to get a copy of it, it's a little bit more expensive than I would like, but mainly because it's 435 pages long, so the printing costs are pretty hefty for me. Out of that, I earn $2 per copy. Yay! Life of a writer. But, you know, if I was to sell it cheaper, I would be paying Amazon royalties.
They've got enough.
The system is so rooted, as we say in Australia. You know. So people say, why can't it be cheaper? And I go, well, you know, because Amazon say, this is the price, this is how much you're going to get back out of it, and that's it. You know, I can't afford to be spending thousands of dollars having it professionally edited before it gets as far as the publisher and then not earn any money for it from it.
Right. Well, you do.
Yeah, I do.
You're doing it for us.
Yeah, I'm
there. Well, I appreciate it. And this has been a great, great time.
It's lovely speaking to you guys. Yeah. And I'll get in touch with you when the sequel to the 7th of December comes out, because that's
always
another action-packed spy thriller set during the Blitz.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it'd be good to keep up a relationship. I like being interviewed.
Yeah, you know, and
that sounds petty, but it sounds a bit sort of patting myself on the back. But, I don't get to talk to a lot of people living by myself.
No. Living by yourself and everybody moved away.
And people hate talking.
But
it's great. Thank you for being kind.
Well, no, thank you for being
and gentle. You eased it in very slowly.
I told you I would.
Didn't feel
before
a thing.
Before you know it, it's there and you go with it, right? I mean, that's how I operate.
Oh my God!
Oh, poor Dave. You know,
he's so innocent. I know.
Sweet innocent.
He is, but not anymore.
Hanging around now.
Yeah, he's losing it. He's losing it fast.
Thanks, guys, very much indeed.
Thank you.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.